It's episode 25 of Piled High and Deep, the podcast, in your ears. And our journey today is with Peter McGraw. He teaches at the University of Colorado Leeds School of Business. He has his PhD in psychology, and he teaches marketing. So right there, you know that we've got a fascinating journey ahead of us. How does a psychologist, a PhD in psychology, rather, make it into a business school? It makes sense. You got to pay attention. But what's really fascinating is that Peter really had the idea of being a college professor early on. And he had a divergent path, but then found it again. But what's really kind of funny here is that Peter's path to his PhD actually came a little bit lucky, for lack of a better term. You see, when it came time to send the applications out, he applied to the good schools and had some mixed results. But on a whim, he decided to really reach for the stars, and he sent an application to The Ohio State University. And he got a telephone call from the woman that would be his mentor. But it wasn't the kind of call he expected.
I'm calling with some good news and some bad news. The good news is you've been admitted to the PhD program at Ohio State University. The bad news is it's not in the program that you applied to. So I had been rejected by the social psych program.
Now, Peter really admits that he didn't know anything about the program he'd been admitted to. But what he did know is that he was getting into a program, into an area of psychology he was really interested in. It was quantitative psychology. That's the study of emotions and judgments that factor into the decisions that we make on a daily basis. Well, let's fast forward 7 years. Peter has his PhD in psychology, and after completing a 2-year postdoc at Princeton, he decides that it's time to realize that dream that he'd really had since high school. Time to become a university professor. But that path didn't go to a psychology department. That's where it takes the turn to the business school.
What was happening at that time was there were a bunch of people like me who had studied judgment and decision making who were heading into business schools. And they were heading into business schools in part because business schools weren't training enough PhDs to meet their demand. And business schools have had a tradition of pulling from the basic sciences, economics, anthropology, and psychology, to do more applied work.
And for Peter, that work begins by teaching undergrads about consumer behavior as they're beginning their process of business school education. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by me, Ted Conte Jr., Mountain Geek Productions. Thanks for listening. Episode 25, I can't believe it. It's been just over a year since I started this little project, and 25 episodes later, I'm stumbling along. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate your time. Hope you enjoy what you're hearing, and please, always looking for comments on whatever platform you are using to listen to podcasts. Just make a comment, or you can ping me on the internet at themountaingeek.net or on social media. Twitter's probably the best place. At Mountain Geek is my handle, or you can find the podcast Twitter feed at PhD, the podcast. Peter McGraw is starting his own podcast. In fact, it drops, I believe, on the same day I'll be dropping this, Wednesday, April 25th. So I'll have some other details on it. I'll also be tagging Peter in my Twitter feed, and I'll give you a link on the information page to check out Peter's other writings and exploits. Well, here we go. Let's start shoveling with Dr. Peter McGraw.
That I'm an old radio guy.
Uh-huh.
Just for my own creativity, I like to have some radio sensibilities in it.
Yeah, that's great. I'm a little jealous because I'm starting this podcast, and I'm doing it a little bare bones in terms of my time. I've hired someone to help with a lot of the kind of detailed stuff, but
well, I think that's the beauty of the medium, is that you can do with it whatever you want.
It's true, yeah.
And I think that people going into it, when they download your podcast, people are going to listen to it because of your sensibilities, mm-hmm. not necessarily the preconceived notions that they may have when they're familiar with, you know, a high packaged, high production NPR public radio type of podcast. Now, I love those. I listen to a lot of them. And mm-hmm. like I said, I'm a huge radio fan, but the podcast medium really lets you do anything.
Yeah.
You
it's
want.
Like you can be a garage band or you yeah. could be Lady Gaga. Right. Right? Yeah. That's
absolutely.
That's a good way to think
and
about
at the end of the day, it's about the information that you're getting out to people. At least for me, mm-hmm. I'm looking to present somebody's story. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's an opportunity to inspire somebody down the road because, you know, you can point to it via your social media. Hey, you may have heard about my other stuff, but I'm really talking about what my path is here. Mm-hmm. So go listen to Piled High and Deep, the podcast.
Right.
So, and that's, I wasn't a very good student
okay.
here. I mean, 5.5 of the best years of my life were here in Boulder. I ran the college radio station with some friends and found the girl of my dreams. Yeah. But other than that, at one point, I think that they were just happy to be rid of me.
You know, okay, so I want to disagree. Well, first of all, congratulations on finding the girl of your dreams. But, you know, running the college radio station, like, that's training for life.
Well, absolutely.
Right.
It is, yeah.
More than getting an A- in chemistry, you know, I mean.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the path that I took at college, you know, I definitely had a game plan in place until mm-hmm. we decided we didn't want to leave Denver and raise a family, and so I went down the insurance route,
okay.
thanks to my father-in-law. But, you know, it's probably, I like to say it's the worst, best decision I ever made because, man, take a look at the radio industry now.
It's true.
It is a mess.
Yeah, look, people need insurance.
Yes, everybody needs insurance.
People need insurance.
Yes, and there are a heck of a lot of options when it comes to radio. But how did you find yourself with a PhD?
Wow, so it really depends on how detailed you want me to go. I've got a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea behind this is to tell the story. I'm probably going to interrupt you. We're going to go back
sure.
and forth. And, you know, it's two guys sitting at a coffee shop or a bar who just run into each other. And I find out that you have a PhD and
like,
you don't have anything better to do.
How did you get that PhD?
Yeah, right.
Well, so I took a psychology class as a high school student, and which is actually the perfect time for a kid to take a psychology class because it just helps you figure some things out that are puzzling. And I had a great teacher as my best height, you know, like best teacher. It was a really meaningful experience. And so when I went to Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey. Thank God it's not called the University of New Jersey. It sounds like I have a fancier degree
right.
than I actually do. And I was an engineer. So I started off as an engineer, a very practical decision. Like, I was pretty good at STEM. I didn't like STEM, but I was pretty good at it, you know. And coming from kind of a sort of working class, you know, lower middle class kind of family, and one that had really struggled at times. Like, we were on food stamps at one point. Like, it was
blue collar family, blue collar.
Well,
parents.
You know, single mom, secretary. You know, that kind of thing.
Was the expectation, though, by mom that you're going to college?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was not in doubt. Now, not everybody in my family goes to college. So my mom hadn't gone to college. My sister didn't go to college. My dad sort of went to college. He went to four colleges but limped along and made it out. No one gets a postgraduate degree. You know, So this was a family that's, you know, they're, you know, just kind of, we're making our way, you know, just typical struggles. And I was kind of identified early, like, you know, I tested well. I was one of these kids. I can take a test, you know? And so for her, and I remember there was a time in high school where I was like, oh, maybe, I don't know, you know, kind of thing. And she's like, you are going to college. Like, this was not negotiable. in any way. And so engineering was a good choice because it leads to good careers.
Right.
Right. This is a practical decision. You don't follow your passion when you're poor.
Right.
At least I wasn't thinking. I didn't have passions per se. Probably, and the closest thing I had to one, as an aside, I think passions are overrated, and I'll tell you why later if you want to.
No, it's definitely one of those things I want to talk about because you are here in the business school.
Yes.
And I think that we have kids today who have a passion for computers and things electronic, yeah. And they think that that's the path they want to go down when it's not necessarily the right way to plan a career for everybody. But let's go back.
Yeah.
So you're a STEM kid. You have those skills. Engineering is going to be that path.
It's going to be that path.
It's going to pay the bills.
And then, you know, one thing that you don't realize is that, you know, these engineering schools, these big state schools are not designed for you to succeed. They're designed to weed, you know, half the students
right.
out, which is good for the rest of the school because you populate your arts and sciences with a bunch of really smart students. And I was one of those students. So I dropped out of engineering basically within my first semester. It just, you know, I wasn't really picking up what they were putting down. And I had this intro to psych class. Not that I did terribly well in that either, but at least I liked it. And so I switched over, and I remember my mom asking me, my grandfather asking me, what are you going to do with a psychology degree? You know, they weren't embracing a liberal.
Right.
I couldn't say, well, I'm getting a liberal arts education. I'm getting a good foundation for life. I said, oh, I'm going to become a professor. And to me, it just seemed like a good answer because I get to read books. I get to lecture on these interesting things. I get to be on a college campus, which I was in love with. I you know, to me, college was really liberating. I really blossomed as a person getting out of the house. And so to me, it just seemed like, oh, it's just a nice idea, you know. And I kind of got a little bit off track here and there. I fast forward ahead. I get my degree. I end up doing a master's in education, in part because it was 1992. There was a recession. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I couldn't really find a job. I didn't want to do the rat race management training programs, stuff like that. And so I ended up getting a job doing student affairs work, and it was supported with a graduate assistantship, except I hadn't been admitted to a graduate program. So I kind of like went in non-matriculated.
Was that still at Rutgers? You just stayed at Rutgers.
I stayed at Rutgers, and I did not want to stay in New Jersey. I was...
Duh.
Yeah, I was terrified. First of all, I thought there was a big world out there that I wanted to explore. And then I was terrified that if I stayed 1 minute longer in New Jersey, I would never escape. That I would be the guy who gets a job in New Jersey, meets a woman in New Jersey, gets married in New Jersey, raises New Jersey kids, you know, and so on. And look, I have friends who have done that, and
just wasn't for you.
They live good lives, and I would have been, that would not have been a good life for me. And so I tried to get into graduate school. I applied to all Western universities. I did not, if I was advising myself, I would have said, you're doing this wrong. You know, I just basically picked a bunch of schools in the Western United States. I actually wanted to move to Colorado. I wanted to move to a place, and so I applied to a bunch of the schools. Didn't get in anywhere. I ended up getting a job in student affairs, so I became a hall director at UC Santa Barbara, this idyllic place.
Yeah.
Hardest job I probably ever had.
Did you do the RA thing in college?
I'd done the RA thing. You know, it was a practical decision. Yep. You know, pays room and board. And
did it right over here at Arnett Hall.
Oh,
over in Kitt.
So yep. you know the feeling.
Yep.
Yeah. And I was good at it. You know, I'm an extrovert and I like people. And it was fun. You know, I liked it. And I could balance the sort of authority and the rule enforcement with the social fun thing, with the kind of being supportive of these younger students who
right.
are struggling. I was made to do that in college. I mean, I was I loved it too, and it. I met a great group of students, and you know, I had some mentors. Finally, you know, I got connected, and then one of my bosses took care of me. You know, 2 years later, helped me get a graduate assistantship and an apartment, and you know, and so I don't know what I would have done. You know, and UC Santa Barbara, I applied again, but this time I was starting to get smart about what I wanted to do. So I had read a book by Tom Gilovich called How We Know What Isn't So, The Fallibility of Human Reason in Everyday Life, or Judgment in Everyday Life, something like that. So this was a pop science book 20 plus years ago, before pop science books were a thing. And I read this book, it's a book about decision making and social psychology, and I was like, that's what I want to study. It just... I mean, it was all the stuff that everybody's learning about today, reading Thinking Fast and Slow by Danny Kahneman, reading Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. Like, Tom was writing about this stuff, you know, why we think we have ESP but we don't, you know, things like that. And so, of course, I applied to work with Cornell, among other places, and I was sort of balancing where I wanted to live with what I wanted to do. Got waitlisted at Cornell. Didn't get in. So two strikes. And all along the way, I'm trying to improve my application. Because I was good, but not great.
And this whole time, it was just, you were a psychology. You were looking to go down that psychology PhD path.
Yes.
To a professorship.
Yes.
You weren't looking to become a clinic. You weren't looking at the clinical. You wanted to do research, and that's where your focus was.
Yeah, and I think if you had the day I had arrived at graduate school, if you had said what's your future look like, I would have said, oh, I'm going to end up at a small teaching college somewhere. Like, I'll be mostly a teacher. Like, I thought I would be mostly teaching. The research was. The way I viewed it was the research was something I had to do to get the PhD. It wasn't the purpose of going to graduate school.
Had you had an opportunity to do research when you were in doing your undergrad? Had you attached your – you had said earlier you somebody helped you get the graduate assistant job.
Yes, right. Yeah, no. So I was like – I had a 2.8 at the end of my freshman year. I was not lighting the world on fire. Right. I graduated with a 3.6, which meant that I basically was getting 3.8s, 3.9s, and 4.0s for those remaining 3 years. But their 3.6 is still not, that's when it comes to PhD programs. And I had like a great quant score on my GRE, but my verbal score wasn't so hot. I had taken it 3 times. You know, I had some research experience, so I had done some independent studies when I was an undergrad. And then when I was at UC Santa Barbara, one of the really wonderful things about the program, the housing program that I was working at, was that in your second year, they let you do a one-day-a-week internship. They recognized that these hall directors weren't going to be hall directors forever. We were 24-year-old kids or 28-year-old kids, you know. And so you could go and work in the counseling center or in the student center or something. But I didn't want to stay in student affairs. So I started volunteering in the psych labs on campus. And that's where I started to get a little bit more experience. And I got some better letters and so on. And so I... but yet, you know, this is a winner-take-all world. You know, top programs have 5% acceptance rates and so on. So I remember I did a set of applications. I went on semester at sea, and I mailed my applications from Japan. So I finished them on the 14-day trip to Japan. You know, I was going on this amazing adventure.
Right.
And I was like, well, I'm hoping that when I come back, I'll be able to start a... You know, I'll be starting a PhD program soon after that kind of thing. And I remember this psych professor, Jim Blaskovich, had been kind to me and had advised me a little bit. And I remember him saying, oh, so where'd you do your final set of applications? And, you know, I listed these schools, and these are good schools. You know, I applied to Cornell again and so on. And I said, oh, and then I decided last minute, I put in applications to Michigan and Ohio State. And he said, well, you wasted your money. And I was like, okay. You know, like, he's like, you're
thanks
never
for the vote of confidence.
Yeah, he's
Scott.
Like, you're never getting in those places. And you know, and in hindsight, he was absolutely correct. I didn't get into Michigan. I got waitlisted at Cornell again. And then one day I get a call from my eventual mentor and advisor, Barbara Mellers. And I didn't know who she was. She calls me. She says, hi, Pete. This is Barbara Mellers from Ohio State. I'm calling with some good news and some bad news. The good news is you've been admitted to the PhD program at Ohio State University. The bad news is it's not in the program that you applied to. So I had been rejected by the social psych program. Not surprising. They at that time were a top three program in the world in this top, you know, in this topic. Like, people turned down Princeton and Stanford
to go to Ohio State,
you know, kind of thing. And did they tell you they did.
Right.
Also. Barb was what we might call a behavioral economist today, but she's a quantitative psychologist in the quantitative psychology program. She had been there a year, so she was a new faculty member. She's kind of mid-career, really ambitious, smart, eager to get a student.
She needed bodies.
Academia is a huge pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she needed, that's my joke, but there's some truth to it. But, you know, it's just she wants an apprentice. I mean, the way to say it in a way that's flattering, and I think in the case of Barb, is she wants an apprentice because she wants to build something impressive, and she needs someone to knock down walls, to do demo, and to learn over the course of 5 years how to do what she can do and move from having this collaboration, you know, like from a thing where you have a teacher and student to then true collaborators.
Right.
And what she did was, I mean, every so often I just send her a thank you note. She was looking at the quant psych applicants, and there was no one for her. Like, these are people who want to study structural equation modeling and psychometrics, statistical techniques. And so, I mean, these are real nerds, and she needs like half a nerd, you know.
She needs somebody that's got a little bit more human to them.
Yes, she studies judgment and decision making, emotions and decision making, which is exactly what I wanted to study. I didn't even know she existed. I wanted to work with her husband, who was in the social psych group. So she walks down the hallway one afternoon, and she goes to the social psych departmental secretary. Can I look through your reject pile? So she just grabs 50 folders, you know, stamped no, so to speak.
Right.
And she just starts flipping through them, and she finds mine. You know, this guy's got pretty good quant skills, has done a master's in education. He's taken a bunch of statistics courses. He wants to study decision making. He wants to work with my husband, you know, and what do I have to lose? Because I got nothing else. And so I said, I visited, and I said, maybe, because I was holding out for
Cornell.
And the person ahead of me on the list at Cornell took the position the last day that you're allowed to make a decision. And I called her up. I said, I'm coming to Ohio State.
I want to stop here for a second.
Okay.
Because that's a pretty big step in a kid's life.
Yeah, I was 27.
Okay.
I was kiddish.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kiddish.
How are you viewing your future at this point? Are you still thinking you're going professor?
Yeah.
That's still the attitude that you have.
Yes.
Yeah, Walking into Ohio State, you're going, in 5 years, I'll have my PhD. I'll find a nice college to put
nice,
my
quiet
roots
place.
Down. And that'll be that.
Yes. That's what I was thinking.
All righty.
I was excited to be going to move from Santa Barbara to Columbus, Ohio, which sounds crazy, but it felt right to me. I mean, if I think about it, 1988, I say, I'm going to become a professor. 1993, I'm rejected. 1995, I'm rejected. 1997, I get in. Right. So, I worked hard, you know, studying for that GRE, getting, you know, working the extra hours, doing all that stuff. I mean, when I put my mind to something,
you get it done.
It's going to get done. It's not a matter of if, it's when, you know, I mean, within reason. And so I'm excited about that.
And was it just you going to Columbus?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was, I'm pretty on my own.
Okay.
Yeah. I had some family back in New Jersey, but yeah, I,
that was
solo.
It.
I'm still solo. I'm a bachelor. I never got married. Yeah. But yeah, that was good. And then for me to turn out the way I did, I had to like the research.
What were those first two or three years as you're getting, did you do 5 years there?
I did.
So what were the first two or three years? So the basics of putting together your dissertation, what built up to that?
So this was a really rigorous place. You know, everybody's smart and ambitious. And so, you know, you're taking a lot of classes in your first two and a half years. We're on quarters, so we were usually taking three courses at a time for across 10 weeks. And this was a great place because there were lots of seminars to take. So you're taking that course load. I was working as a research assistant for Barb. And she got me going day one. So basically the first day we met in August when I arrived, she gave me one of her forthcoming papers to read. And I spent 4 hours reading it. Like, it took me 4 hours to read that paper.
What was your initial, was it a, oh my God, what am I doing here? I mean, were you overwhelmed or were you excited? Was there trepidation? What do you remember about?
Well, I felt like a poser. I definitely had imposter syndrome. It would be impossible for me to not have imposter syndrome. Everybody else had turned down Stanford and Princeton and Michigan to come there. And I had been pulled out of their reject pile. Like, I didn't make the cut compared to all of my friends. So I don't mind being an underdog, you know, and I didn't, and I always had the, my personal view was always that of, you can't outwork me. That was my view. It was my view as an athlete, you know, it was just always my view. It was my view in undergrad when I turned my 2.8 into a 3.8,
yeah,
3.95 one semester. It's like, go to the party on Friday night. I'll spend 4 hours at this desk doing the statistics. You know, it's just like, to me, it's just math. You know, I mean, this is how bad I am. I mean, people are going to think I'm a freak, but I think people have to hear this stuff because if they want to do a PhD, they need to hear what it's like. I once decided, so I had a friend who would show up at the lab around 10. And I would show up around 9. I started showing up at 9. And part of the reason I did that was, I was like, well, let's see. If I show up at 9 and everybody else is showing up at 10, and we all work till 10 p.m., well, that's an extra hour every week. That's 325 hours a year. At the end of 5 years, that's 1,500 extra hours that I've worked. And that's an extra paper. And the currency in my world are papers. Right? If you don't have them, you don't get jobs. If you don't have them, you don't get tenure. If you have lots of them and they're really good, you live a good life as an academic. And so for me, it was like, oh, well, an hour a day turns into 1,500 hours, turns into an extra paper. It's easy math, you know. And because I was enjoying the work, I found it challenging. Of course, it was challenging. It was it's the hardest thing I did in my life, at least career-wise. And you know, the more you do the work, the it never comes easy, but it comes easy. It hits that sort of sweet spot where it's moderately difficult and then can become enjoyable.
Do you believe in the 10,000 hours thing?
Yes, yes, except 10,000 hours is not the right way to think about it. In my opinion, the way to think about it is to think about it. So I talked about being an apprentice. Like, I actually believe that this sort of craftsperson view is really useful for academics. So becoming, getting a PhD in as a research psychologist is not like becoming a medical doctor or a lawyer. It's like becoming a plumber. And so what happens is like on your first day as a plumber, all you can do is tear that toilet out of the floor and carry stuff, you know, and sweep up. But what happens is you work with a master plumber, and then you realize how to start to think about plumbing. And you don't learn, like, you don't learn laws, right? You don't learn steadfast, like, these are the if X, then Y. What you learn is a way to think about how pipes fit together and how to solve problems, right? There's an infinite number of ways to put in a bathroom. And so for me, the issue is, yeah, you need to spend the hours in order to get enough experience and to allow that learning to happen. But the nature of those 10,000 hours matter. That is 10,000 hours of entering data.
You're not learning anything.
You're not learning anything. Like you're now a factory worker. You're not a plumber, right? You know, and so what has to happen with those hours is, yeah, you're producing things. Like, yeah, I ran studies. I did a lot of grunt work. But you're also like reading and thinking and talking. And I was lucky. Barb was in the office a lot, and I could go to her office at any time. And she would stop what she's doing, sit down with me, and work on whatever we were working on. I have this pile of scrap paper right here. I will like mimic her. Like a student will be sitting in your seat, and we'll start talking this through. And then I'll just grab a piece of paper, and then I'll just grab a pen, and I'll just start drawing figures and things and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, oh my God, I am my advisor. You know.
So she did good by you.
Oh, I mean, yeah, exactly.
Can you point? I'll get to the research on the dissertation here in a minute. Can you point to like an aha moment where you stopped feeling like that poser, like you do belong?
Yes. It happened in 2009.
Okay.
So it happened 12 years later.
Okay.
I mean, not fully. I mean, actually, there are moments in time, I think.
Let's talk about when did you feel like you really belonged and were going to succeed with Barb?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, it's
what was your attitude after the first year? Do you remember?
Oh, I was stoked. I was so happy. I mean, you know, I had some hard moments as a graduate student. I'd say my third year probably was my hardest year. I had a girlfriend that was causing some struggles. I had too many balls in the air, and Barb let me have it. I mean, she's a kind, supportive person, but she's not to be messed with. You kind of need that.
Yeah. So you dropped the ball on something. And
on a project, and she laid into me. And that was hard. That was hard to hear. I probably wish she hadn't done it exactly the way she did. But, you know, she was right. And I had to, what I did was I basically went and spent a day and I wrote up a plan. I mean, I can't even imagine a graduate student doing this with me. I wrote up a plan and met with her the following day and said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to drop this class. I'm going to move, you know, I'm going to move these things around. This is going to become my priority. You know, I just came up with a... whatever. I don't know. I don't know what happened.
Well, you said that there's nobody that's going to outwork you.
Yeah. So I was just like, I just have to get my priorities right. And I have to know who I need to take care of.
Right.
And someone had given me the advice when I had – they had said to me, the best thing that you can do as a graduate student is for your advisor to believe that they can't live without you. And so I was like, okay, that seems like solid advice to me. And so, you know, and these are people who are mid-career. They're like, they're kind of, I should see how old Barb and Phil. I ended up working with Phil Tetlock, who's her husband. I worked with both of them. I wonder how old they are at that time. Maybe they're around the same age as I am now, which I know what that feeling is like. You know, you're kind of in the sweet spot of your career. You have the energy. You know enough to be dangerous, and you still have a lot that you want to do. Like, they would say, oh, why don't you, on a Saturday, say, oh, why don't you come by the house? And so I would drive over to their house, and I would meet with Barb while Phil played with their kid, and then Barb would take the kid, and then Phil and I would meet, you know, and then sometimes on Sunday, the next day, they'd be like, well, why don't you come by the house? And to me, I was like, of course, what a great opportunity. I forgot your question.
I forgot what my question is. All this too, but I think.
Oh, about when I stopped feeling like a poser? Oh, about, you said about.
When did you feel like you were going to succeed? But I think you answered that.
Yeah.
Is that aha moment came for you when Barb laid into you, you put together a plan, you responded, you knew. Your train is back on the track.
Yeah.
I want to ask you the question.
What's that?
So somebody told you, make sure that your advisor feels like they can't live without you.
Yes, you're indispensable, I think was the word they used.
How do you feel now here as a professor at this University of Colorado lead school of business?
Mm-hmm. Do I have a student like that?
Do you have students like that? Have you had students like that?
I have had a student like that. So his name's Caleb Warren. He's now an assistant professor at the University of Arizona. We still work together. So he wasn't he didn't do his dissertation with me. But I published 6 papers with Barb, and that's pretty good.
Yep.
The average student probably
2 or 3.
Yeah,
if that.
One, you know. And so I don't know how many papers I've published with Caleb, but all the humor research that I've done has been with him, hand in hand. And I know I couldn't have done it without him. He's incredible. He's a great thinker. He's very broadly read. He's a good writer, and he's ambitious, and he can tolerate me. Like, he will, you know, most students just, I'm too intense for them. But Caleb just every time he responded, he delivered, you know, and it was fun. It's still fun, you know. And so I had one of those students. And, you know, one student can be a career maker. You know, one top student or one every 10 years is a career maker, you know, because it's a skewed distribution. Like, most students are okay, and then a few are extraordinary.
How many do you have right now?
You know, I don't have anybody who I'm working super closely with. I have a student working as a research assistant right now. We have a small program. We have 7 students here.
All right. So let's talk about the now.
Sure.
Let's talk about what you're doing now, and then we'll get back to the dissertation, because something tells me that what you're known for now probably is not what your dissertation was related to.
No.
Okay. So, all right. So let's talk about the now. You're here at University of Colorado Boulder,
mm-hmm.
Leeds School of Business, full professor?
I'm associate.
You're associate?
I've been putting off going up for full. I really don't want to grow up.
Right.
It's coming.
Too much responsibility in that? Or, yeah. Well, not too much, but some additional layers of responsibility with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm ready to do it. But, you know, what happens is, you know, as assistant, the more junior you are, the more you're kind of taken care of. You're given more space to create. And I still love the research. Like, I just like to get up in the morning and write and work on these ideas. And so anything that gets in the way of that, I try to resist. And you know, and as you become more prominent and more successful, the downside of success is you get more invites to do podcasts.
That's right.
Yeah. And you, right? Like, you get more calls from journalists, or you get invited to give talks. And all of those things are incredibly flattering, important for your career, and important for the university to be seen as a thought leader. But it gets in the way of the, you know, the... I don't want to say the important work, because it all has important things, but the work that I find so valuable.
So let's talk personally about that work.
Sure.
I found you because you wrote a book called The Humor Code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a journalist.
With a journalist.
Yes, yeah.
So tell me, we'll get to that.
Sure.
I guess the basic idea of it is the role, what is humor, and what is it, what the role plays in the role that humor plays in not just business, but in society in general?
Yeah, so I made a decision to not write the book as a business book. And I did that in part because I wanted to try to make it broader. The book answers the question, what makes things funny? And it does it as sort of part memoir, part pop science, part travelogue. And that would be more fun. I thought that was a fun way to do the book. I thought it could be more broadly applicable. Also, I wrote that book with this journalist, Joel Werner, at a time where I was still new to the topic. So normally what happens is a professor writes a book when as his or her opus, you know. So my postdoc advisor, Danny Kahneman, I just so happened to get to work with a Nobel laureate. You talk about lucky in life. You know, he writes Thinking Fast and Slow. It's based upon 30 years of his research. You know, it's his it is his opus. For me, I had only been studying that topic for a few years. So what I decided to do was I did want to write a pop science book. I did want to try to be a thought leader, and I wanted to see what that life would be like. And I think it's important for universities to sort of to be better about this. Otherwise, people think Malcolm Gladwell is the expert rather than the person that Malcolm Gladwell's he's reading his
right.
their papers, you know. And so the only way I could do that at that time was to make it a book about discovery. So the book's written as a kind of learning on the fly, traveling the world, trying to crack the humor code.
What, where did that book fall after the, we'll get back to the dissertation, I know I will. Where did that book fall? Were you already here at CU by the time you wrote that?
Yeah,
by the time humor became kind of your focus?
Yeah, so it was, I was an assistant professor when I kind of stumbled on this question of what makes things funny. I think maybe Caleb was like a third year student or something like that. Maybe he was a fourth year student. I was headed towards tenure, so it was late there. I remember, so there's a scene in the Humor Code, and actually is what got the Humor Code started, is Joel basically asked me to go to a comedy club, actually a dive bar that does an open mic, and to critique the comedians using humor theory. I have this theory of what makes things funny. He wanted me to say, why are these guys not funny? Why are they funny? And
that was totally a Gary Shandling moment right there, by the way.
Totally. And he said, and I said, oh, well, why don't I tell some jokes? Why don't I get up on stage and tell some jokes? I thought it'd be fun. And, a bit of hubris, I would say. And so that's what we did. So I showed up there. And it was the night before. So this was in 2001. It was the night before was it 2001 or 2000? The night before 2001, I think. I turned in my tenure packet, right? So that's where it was happening. I had published one paper on the topic. I was working on some others. So it was, you know, it wasn't the thing that got me tenure.
The book wasn't the thing that got
me
tenure.
No, clearly no. No one cares about that book when it comes to tenure decision. In English, they might, but here they don't. They care about business publications.
Right.
But it really took off post-tenure. So it was a sweet spot, you know, like it was picking a topic like that is a little risky pre-tenure. Tenure is designed for people to take risks, and this was a good one, I think. And I knew then I had gotten my house in order enough that I was sort of confident enough that I'd be okay and I could get started on writing a book and doing some things before the
To get a little off topic of the hard business school
stuff. And what I realized is that there was so little good basic science around it that I had to do the basic theoretical work first before I could start to do the business stuff. And so what's happening now is people are starting to use the theory for business research.
All righty. So that lays the foundation for going back to the dissertation, because we're talking psychology here.
Yes.
And you teach in the business school.
Yes.
So let's talk about how you I'm just going to guess. Well, rattle off the dissertation title first.
Oh, my goodness.
Come on.
I think I have it.
Looking around the office.
I have it in a little slim volume somewhere over here. It's something about self-esteem and risky choice, I think.
Close enough.
Yeah. You know, I never published it.
It just went to committee and
I had spectacularly null findings. You know, I did my dissertation. I did a couple things in a non-standard way as a graduate student. I mean, in ways that seem completely perplexing now, knowing what I know about the business. So the first one is I took a semester off and went on semester at sea again, which is crazy given the stakes.
Right.
But it was, a chance to travel the world again. And so I basically bought an enormous box of papers and studied for my qualifying exam on the boat. I can't imagine advising any student to do that. But I did it.
Well, because they don't need the papers anymore. They just read it all electronically.
No, but I mean, you know, it's just like the stakes are so high. Right. Like the idea that you would take a semester off. You know, it's just such a critical time in your career. The other one is I was lucky because I had a number of papers and pubs already, but I didn't have anything that I could have easily turned into a dissertation, in part because I had been working so closely with these professors that I didn't have anything that really felt it was totally mine. And a dissertation obviously should be your ability to act independently. And so I was graduating. I was heading to this postdoc at Princeton he wasn't a Nobel laureate at the time, but he was basically within a week of me arriving there. I mean, correlation, right. Not causation. But so I came up with this idea in the spring. I think late fall, I did some sort of proposal. And then in the spring, I kind of started really in earnest planning it. In May, I ran the studies, and in June and July, I wrote the dissertation. Yes. I worked, and I did it. I did 12-hour days every single day for 2 months.
And that's at the end of, so that's the last year of your 5 years at Ohio State.
And I can't start the postdoc without the PhD.
So you're already accepted to the postdoc.
Yes.
But you can't.
Yes. So I defended at the last possible moment. And
what was there a correlation between self-esteem and risk taking?
So the idea essentially was, so there had been, so it was about physical risks. Like it was sort of, you know, like I was like, I had created these games where you threw this ring and you had to choose what distance. And so the idea essentially was the idea that I had, and it was based on some previous work, was that self-esteem can serve as this buffer against regret. And so the idea essentially was that higher self-esteem folks would make a different set of choices than lower. Like, so essentially the interesting thing that the previous research had found is in general is that like you kind of, there's this sort of sweet spot. You don't want to be too far away where you never succeed, right? That's like chucking half-court shots all the time. Versus being too close, like where it's sort of too boring and so on. And there's, you know, so I was sort of looking at the distance that people chose, and I was trying to use this individual difference to predict this. And then I had been gathering a bunch of research, a bunch of data about how they feel about their results and so on. And so I was trying to model the data. I mean, I spent weeks working on the data, and it just was at best, it was inconclusive.
So this was probably a PhD, a dissertation mm-hmm. that not so much proved or supported a specific theory or broke new ground. This was probably a dissertation that more showed your ability to to prove that you understood the methodologies needed to support research, and that the next thing that you do is probably going to be better. But hey, kid, you understood the basics of it. Move along.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, it was theoretically grounded. My advisor, the paper that she gave me on day one of my graduate training that I took me 4 hours to read, was about this, what she called decision affect theory. So it's about how anticipated emotions affect choices. My dissertation used that theory in this different context and was looking at it from an individual different standpoint. Was I swinging for the fences? No. It ended up being a thing was like, okay, this guy's competent.
And
he's able to clear this bar. I tried to figure out a way to publish that work. I even wrote up a journal article for it and read it and basically sent it to Barb and said, I don't think you should bother reading this. I don't think that we have a publication right here. You know,
I'm only episode 25 into this project of mine.
Okay.
I don't know where it's going to lead. But I will say that early on in this process, I kind of had this assumption that people get PhDs when they break new ground, when they find new things, they support new ideas.
No.
Absolutely. What I'm finding
yeah.
is that those letters after the name
mm-hmm.
aren't so much about the new stuff that they've uncovered. It's about working through the process so eventually
yeah.
you'll be able to get to the new stuff.
Yes.
Is that a fair?
That's totally fair. So the way I characterize our program is we're teaching you how to write good papers. Right? Teaching you how to write good papers. So, yeah, you need the coursework because you need the background. And you need to be able to – so then you need to – in order to write a good paper, you need to have a particular set of skills that you learn from working closely, collaborating with more experienced people, from taking classes, to hanging out with your pals and talking about the world that you're working in. And the idea is this is – what you hope will be the case is that you continue learning – as an assistant professor and as an associate professor. So you're not just writing good papers, but you're writing now great papers. And it's not a 5-year PhD is not enough to learn how to write a great paper.
But to get to that paper.
Yes.
Those steps include learning how to sit in class.
Yes.
And properly digesting and brewing and noodling that information that's being thrown at you in class.
Yes.
Learning how to do research.
Yes.
Learning how to ask the right questions.
Yes.
To understand what that research means, which means that you're back doing research.
Yes.
And then understanding at the end of the day what all that research means. That's the asking the next questions.
Yes. To future directions.
The future directions. Yes. And then vomiting it all on a piece of paper that somebody's going to understand.
And being able to stand up to withering critiques along the way.
Well, that's a personality test a lot of times.
Oh, so yes. So what is it? What I wish we could evaluate when we evaluate PhD candidates is perseverance. Like I've joked that when we have students on campus that we're evaluating to join our program. That we basically take them to a room and we give them a big stack of anagrams. And we say, okay, we want you to do this anagram task. I want you to do as many anagrams as you can. I'll come back in about 20 minutes or so. And then come back in 3 hours. And if the student is still there solving anagrams 3 hours later, I want to work with that student. If they're fiddling on their phone because after 25 minutes or so...
You didn't show up.
They didn't show up. I'm not sure I want to work with that student. Because it's... You're learning so many things so fast. You're required to juggle a lot of responsibilities. It's nothing like being an assistant professor, but you're still doing a lot. And the pressures, the time pressure is so severe, it's really hard. So if you go to graduate school and you have problems, they're going to get worse. Right? So if you kind of have a weak constitution and get sick easily, you're going to get sick more often. If you're having relationship troubles, your relationship's going to become more troubled. If you have depression problems, you're going to have more severe depression. If you have anxiety, it's going to get worse. So there's this part of the world where you have to be kind of physically, psychologically, and emotionally robust.
It's like a 5-year boot camp.
It's the most mundane boot camp that you're ever going to go through.
You're not rolling. You don't have to shoot a gun or
you just
crawl through the mud.
In front of a computer.
But you're going to get broken down, and at the end of the day, you're going to walk away with the golden ticket. And
it isn't for everyone. It's sort of a certain type. You have to kind of be wired a certain way. I think that you have to think about a good life as having a very strong creative element to it. And I think the people who really thrive in academia are people who think of themselves as creative people, because there's so much problem solving and positioning and answering questions, and then just creative work, whether it be running statistical analyses is a creative endeavor. Because there's not just one way to do it. Right, so it requires divergent thinking. Writing is a creative endeavor. There's an infinite number of ways to position a paper. And so if you can have an identified... Look, I think the best plumbers think of themselves as creative people. They don't think of themselves as... They don't paint by numbers, And so that kind of work can be really fulfilling if that's your path to living a good life.
Postdoc at Princeton, how'd you end up there?
So another reason to send a thank you note to Barb. So Barb and her husband Phil had moved to Ohio State from Berkeley, but they had kept their home in Berkeley. And so to avoid the humid Columbus summers, they'd fly back to Berkeley and stay. And so my first full summer there, Barb asked me if I'd like to join them in Berkeley to continue doing the work, because she knew that it would be advantageous for us to be close together. And I had said yes to that in a second. So I drove my car across country and rented a room with some economics graduate students, which is a good way to feel about your life.
Oh, feel good about your life.
Yeah, those are economics grad students. They got a rough road. So that was great. So I just continued it there. She got me some lab space on campus with one of her friends, and I drove up to their house, and I got to be in Berkeley for the summer, which was really fabulous. I did that my first summer between my first and second year, and I did my second summer between my second and third year. And that second summer, she said, Pete, Danny, so Daniel Kahneman. So Danny had kept his house. He had been at Berkeley. He had kept his house. This is why housing prices are so high in the Bay Area. And he would summer in Berkeley instead of in hot, humid Princeton, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he had a deadline. He had a couple chapters that he was working on, and he needed some research assistant help. And Barb said to me, I want you to – Danny needs some help. He'll pay you. You can put aside all of our work because Danny is a genius. And whatever you can do to help him, you should do. And so I was like, okay. And so I remember this because that man wore me out. So I was 29, maybe. He was 68, probably. Like, wow. You know, I think, around there. And we would sit for hours, and I would help him edit these chapters where he'd read the paragraph. He'd have his laptop. I'd have my laptop. I'd follow along. I would give him feedback. And most of the time I was like, oh, that sounds great. And he's like, no. And then he would rewrite the paragraph for 45 minutes with me there, me helping here and there. Then he'd read it again. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's better. He goes, no, it's still terrible. And he would rewrite it again. Like, I was spent at the end of the day. And the 68-year-old man was, like, working through this stuff. It was amazing. And so what happened was I was graduating a few years later. I had looked for some psych jobs, struck out. I had even thought about leaving academia. I actually felt like it was worth it for me to consider what that would look like. So I looked at jobs in like decision analysis and stuff like that. And then I got serious about thinking about postdocs. And there was a really choice postdoc at Princeton that a buddy of mine was doing. And I sent an email to him one day, and he wrote back something like, you know, my episodic memory is not very good, but my affective memory is. And he goes, I enjoyed working with you. you have the position.
Wow.
And that was great. I mean, it was a little bittersweet. Like, it was a little, like, going back to New Jersey didn't fully feel good. But going back to New Jersey, to Princeton, that felt good.
Was that just a year?
2 years.
2 years.
Two great years.
What came out of that?
So I'll admit it, I had some fun. I was single, recently single again, and was like dating in New York. And I had a great, really great group of grad students and postdocs I made friends with. 'Cause Princeton's kind of a sleepy town, but it was fun having a bunch of young, like,
was it like a 90-minute train ride to the city?
Yeah, it was sort of probably two hours door to door when you really got down to it all. But I had a friend who was a professor at Columbia, and he had a 2-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side. So I had a bedroom in the city whenever I wanted it. So I worked hard and played hard. That was really fun. And I worked with Danny. We only published one paper. It took us 8 years to publish it. The man is thorough. but I also ended up having a bunch of other really productive collaborations with other folks, a guy Eldar Shafir and Alex Todorov, and published some papers with those guys. And then I kind of cleared my, you know, I cleared up, got some stuff out that had been lagging, you know, and got positioned for the job market.
What happened after the postdoc?
So I did a
I mean, let me ask you.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Were you thinking down the psychology line, or were you expanding where else you could go?
Yeah. So it was interesting. What was happening at that time was there were a bunch of people like me who had studied judgment and decision making, who were heading into business schools. And they were heading into business schools in part because business schools weren't training enough PhDs to meet their demand. And business schools have had a tradition of pulling from the basic sciences, economics, anthropology, and psychology, to do more applied work. And at that time, there was kind of this rush into marketing, management, and OB programs. And Danny was a big proponent of that. He saw the business schools as having better resources. You could get better placed. And your work just naturally meshed with the problems that business schools are interested in studying. Managerial decision making, consumer behavior, and so on. And so he had been sending his students to business schools for a few years. I had already started thinking about that as a potential path around my third year in graduate school because I was paying attention. And I had made some critical choices. For instance, sending a paper to the Journal of Consumer Research instead of sending it to a social psychology journal.
Gotcha.
It was a hedge. I also thought that consumer decision-making is such a big part of decision-making. It would be a great topic to study. So when you're doing basic theoretical work, you could pick any case study you want. And so I just started gravitating to consumer case studies. And so by that time, it was pretty clear that I was going to head to a business school. There's with some trepidation. You know, what happens is this, is you're a psychology student. You fall in love with social psychology, let's say. It's easy to fall in love with social psychology. And then you go to a social psych program or something similar like I did. And then you imagine teaching social psychology. And then one day you start going, oh, I'm going to be teaching marketing. But you don't have a real full understanding of what marketing is. What you think marketing is selling people shit they don't need and advertising. Which the first thing is that's bad marketing.
Yeah.
And advertising is just the tiniest sliver of marketing. It's just the one that you see. And so you're not well versed in what it is you're really getting into. And so the loss of giving up social psychology looms large. The benefit of this new area doesn't. And so it creates some trepidation. But for me, it was a practical matter. You know, it was like I wanted to work in academia. I didn't want to work in a decision analysis firm, or I don't know what the hell I would have done. So I did the search. And ended up getting a job here at CU.
This is my
first real job.
Your first real job.
The office we're sitting in is the same office. I have not moved offices in 14 years. Like I'm in, and I, you know, and if you look around, you might be able to guess why.
Right.
I like decorated the office.
Yeah.
I don't want to take the paintings off the walls. Like I don't.
Well, the paint's held up pretty well for 14 years.
It has. Well, yeah.
Has it been painted at least once?
They did some. Yeah, it has been painted once.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. I mean, my career has expanded in other ways, but in some ways, I'm like, I remember like walking into this office and sitting at this desk like the day I got here.
What was when you started off here? Then was your focus that marketing, helping students understand decision making and the psychology of consumer behavior? Is that where you started?
Yeah, I started. I taught consumer behavior to undergrads for 10 years. And what was interesting was the class started out as like a psychology class with a sprinkling of marketing. And by year 10, it was like 40% psychology, 60% marketing.
How do you what did you do to change that?
So one is that I just started to – I learned –
You learned marketing.
I learned marketing better. And then what I also learned was it wasn't fair to the students not to give them – you need – for that class, you can't have 100% marketing and 0% psychology. You can't have 100% psychology, 0% marketing. You need it like 50-50. Like they need to understand strategy and tactics and branding and these sort of basic foundational ideas of marketing. And then they need to understand how the psychology of the consumer fits into the problems associated with branding, with pricing, and so on in that way. So it was just, I think, a natural evolution of not being lazy, right? Wanting to be a good professor and give and provide value to the students. Yeah.
Today, what do you teach?
So I teach marketing management to MBAs, to daytime, sometimes evening, and also executive MBAs. So this is the core marketing management course that every MBA student takes in every MBA program in the world kind of thing. So that's a big change.
How often are you teaching?
I usually teach about 3 classes a year, so it's not a heavy load. They give me a lot of space to do the research.
And so let's talk about... Tell me about humor.
Okay.
the humor.
As an aside, yeah. I love teaching that class.
You do.
Oh, I love it. Like if they tried to give me consumer behavior back,
you'd
be like,
fight
really?
It.
Do you really want me to do that? Because I'm suited to teach this class.
What is it about that class that you love?
It's rigorous. Like, it's smart students. They're ambitious.
Do you get pushback from them?
Yes. I love it.
How often are you able to interact with real-world folks on that?
So, I started doing some executive MBA teaching. So those are real-world folks. Yeah. These are folks who work at, you know, big corporations and making career changes and stuff like that. And then about half my friends are in business. And now I'm starting to get more calls, you know, and more conversations with people in the world of business. I'm really focused. I want to spend as little time with academics as I need to. And I want to spend time with comedians, with people creating entertainment, with people who work in business, entrepreneurs. I know what academics are going to say, and I know how they think. Like, I want to talk to these people who have these real-world problems that I can perhaps help with and, you know, learn to, you know, to incorporate into my class and to make my class less and less theoretical, less and less conceptual, and more of that. Look, MBA students like war stories,
yeah,
case studies. I love case-based teaching. I actually think it's valuable. I think you can't have a class that's all case. You can't have a class that's all theory. You need 60-40, you know, theory case.
So what came out of the humor code?
Besides changing my life?
Well, yeah.
So there's an interesting thing that I don't think people realize is when you write a book, you're basically acting like an entrepreneur, right? You're creating a product. You know, it's a marketing endeavor. And so that was kind of fun to do and to think about it in that kind of way. So on one hand, it's a creative endeavor, and on the other hand, it's a business endeavor. You know, the book was a mixed success. So it got tons of press, and it helped sort of solidify me as a true expert. It didn't sell very well. And I think I know why. But what it did was it introduced me to a whole new group of people. You know, like, we went to Palestine and hung out with this three-person sketch television, you know, like these troupe, basically. Right. You know, we went to Hebron one day. Which is, you do not vacation in Hebron, you know, like there's settlers walking around with Uzis and, you know, tanks and stuff like that. Like, well, maybe not tanks. I have this image of tanks, but I don't have a picture of a tank, so I don't trust my memory. In any case, but, you know, and so I got to go to places I wouldn't normally go. I got to meet people that I wouldn't normally get to meet. I get to have an audience with folks I wouldn't never have an audience with. And I get to, like, I mean, it has spurred a whole area of research now. Like, I'm now doing research on the production and consumption of entertainment because I just ended up spending time with people who are making entertainment all the time. And I was like, wow, that's an interesting product. You know, that's an interesting set of problems and so on. So I had a lot of fun. I have a new set of friends.
You get a laugh.
We had lots of laughs. I mean, you know, it was hard work, but we had, you know, I mean, there's when you study humor, you do laugh more often than you study almost anything else.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Do you think that do your fellow academics in these hallways, how do they view your work?
I'd say they're indifferent, probably, most of them. Only because it's just, I think most academics are indifferent about other people's work.
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
They're a little tunnel visioned.
Yeah, I think, you sort of have to be. You know, you can appreciate other people's good work. I do. I know when I read a colleague's paper and I go, I wish I wrote that paper. I can't tell you about my peers here. I have this fun story where I gave a talk at a you know, top business school, and was meeting with one of the professors afterwards. It's usually what happens is you show up, you give a talk in the morning, then you have a day of meetings and meals. And one of the topics at the meetings and meals is the work that you presented. And this guy said to me, he goes, "You know, Pete, I'm really impressed with what you've done with this humor stuff." And I was like, "Oh, thank you." He goes, and then he goes, "'Cause it's a career killer." And I was like, "Thank you." So I think that probably sums up what my average peer thinks, which is, it's pretty cool what you've been able to accomplish in a fairly short period of time. But that was risky. You know, that was...
So maybe that's the next step of... maybe you return a little bit to your roots in terms of the risk analysis. You know, a hardcore academic is, you know, that's too risky to do. I'm not going to get out. I'm not going to look at something funny to hang my hat on.
Yeah, well, you know, the worry is that at first blush, humor seems like a frivolous topic.
Well, yeah.
But I mean, to me, it's far from frivolous. It's such an essential part of life, you know. But here's the thing: those same business school professors will, in their class, talk about how risk and reward are always correlated. Almost anything that's highly rewarding, by virtue of it being highly rewarding, has to be risky. The probability that it's going to work out is going to be low. When you fail, may fail hard, right? Whatever those things might be, you know. And so, well, of course, right? You know what I mean? Like, that's like, and the key, though, of course, is that, and this is getting to your 10,000 hours or what, or the idea is that you spend the time and you get the good training and you exercise these abilities to be able to write not just a good paper, but a great paper. So Caleb and my first paper got into one of the top psych journals, first round, no changes. Which, that may not mean anything to you.
No, it's...
But if you're a psychology, if you've ever submitted a paper, like, that's... I mean, I couldn't believe it. Like, the reviews came in and the editor said, "I'm accepting this paper. You can ignore the reviews." Like, I could not have written that. First of all, I could not have written that paper without Caleb. And I could not have written that paper 3 years earlier. Like, I had to be at that stage where I could write a great paper, you know, at that time. Like, it wasn't just that the idea was good. It was that the execution was there. I have written worse papers since then too, right? Like, it's a lumpy process.
What are you seeing in, you know, is business school still all the rage for kids coming out of high school?
So it seems to be, it's interesting what's happening. As an undergraduate program, it's never been more popular. Maybe I'm being hyperbolic, but it's highly popular. So kids heading into college, they want to go to business schools. We're getting better and better students here at the Leeds School of Business. MBA programs are struggling. I think they're struggling for multiple reasons. I think one is we have a good economy. The other is that business schools have cannibalized their MBA with all these one-year Masters of Science degrees. So you can get a Masters of Science in Analytics in a year here, for instance. And maybe I think there might be some other competing offerings that might, you know, exist. You can do online stuff and so on. Our MBA program has always been sort of a small part of the school. It seems to be holding up okay. Applications are a little up for us, I think in part because Boulder's doing so well. But yeah, I mean, business education is brisk. in general. The NBA's, I think there are places that are scared, and they're scared in part because their NBA programs are big money makers. But of course, the great expense of an MBA is part of the reason why MBA applications are down. It's incredibly, the cost plus the opportunity cost of doing a 2-year MBA when you're 27 years old is not trivial.
Do you miss teaching to undergrads?
No. I don't mind teaching undergrads. I prefer the MBAs and the PhD students because I can teach at a higher level and I can really bring it. Like, I can cold call them and I can, they're more robust. And so I love my undergrads. I have like such fond memories, and I have tons of now friends who I taught, you know, 10 years ago and so on. But like, I also feel like my junior colleagues should get the undergraduate courses. They're a little less heavy a lift, you know, and you can get 3 sections at the same time and do those kinds of things. So I was happy to let that go. I mean, I'll teach anyone who wants to be taught, you know.
You still have a passion for that.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I think the teaching is hard. Oh, I think it's the hardest thing I do because it's just so depleting. This is going to sound weird, but like, if you know a teacher, you should just hug that person, because it is, especially a real teacher, like especially like a junior high school or elementary school teacher, because they have so much face time. Like, the idea of standing up in front of a class and teaching that class, it wears me out, because you're just working so hard. And it's so highly evaluative. It's amazingly depleting. And so the only way to really do that is to actually like bring even more enthusiasm to it. I mean, these poor students, right? Think about it. They have to sit for at least an hour and 15 minutes. Most of my classes are back to back, so it's basically 3 hours. And they have to sit there and pay attention for 3 hours. And they have to look at this ugly face, you know what I mean, and be excited about this stuff. Like, that is hard to do. And so to me, I owe it to them to do whatever I can to not only make the lessons valuable, but to make it engaging. Like, I want my students to be like, what's Pete going to do today? You know, that kind of thing. Like, to be looking forward to, they don't want to be late because they don't want to get in trouble, but they don't want to be late because they don't want to miss something, right? And so that's hard, you know. And I'm like 50% of the way there. Like, I think in the same way that I have so much to learn to write great papers, I have so much to learn to become a great teacher.
Traveling a lot too?
I am. Yeah.
Because I know you and I have been trying to catch up. And, no, it's fine. You know, it's partially, you know, I still have young kids at home. Not young kids, but teenagers. Uh-huh. And you have those things. But what? Australia. And where were you 2 weeks ago?
Dubai.
Dubai.
I was in Dubai. Yeah.
Do you do a lot of corporate speaking?
No.
Or academic?
I do a lot of academic talks, which is nice. It's really flattering to get asked. I want to do more corporate stuff. I haven't hit on something that... So why did the Humor Code not sell well? Part of the reason the Humor Code did not sell well is it doesn't solve a major problem. Right? So it solves a curiosity, but it doesn't solve a major problem. Because most people aren't walking around going, I need to be funnier. And businesses are clearly not thinking, we need to be funnier. It helps on the margin. It doesn't help with their major problems. And so I've tried to facilitate some of that. And I've gotten a little – occasionally, you know, someone like Viacom will call and say, hey, we want you to give a talk, you know, like that kind of thing. But I do my fair share of travel, in part because of the research, because I get interesting invites – you know, and so on in that way. And I, you know, as I said earlier, I'm solo. So I get bored easily. And so I love living here, but it's nice to get away and wear myself out and then come back and eat salads and right. do yoga, you know.
You don't even have a dog or a cat to worry about?
No, I have two plants.
Well, we've gone a ways over here. Thanks, Peter. I appreciate your time. This was a great conversation, and I'll make sure that there's a link to the book on, you know, for folks that can check it out.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Dr. Peter McGraw up at the University of Colorado Leeds School of Business. And best of luck on your podcast, Peter. I will post a link to your Twitter handle as I'm posting this out. And let me know if I can offer any assistance in this podcast endeavor. Episode 25 is in the books. Thank you very much for listening. And as always, please give me a comment on whatever distribution channel you are using to listen to podcasts. You can also poke at me at The Mountain Geek on Twitter and PhD The Podcast on Twitter as well. Now, I do have a confession to make. This episode was edited on an airplane this morning as I was flying out to San Francisco. I'm in a hotel room near San Mateo, California, having to do the day job that really pays the bills, but helping some folks recover some insurance proceeds from the fire that happened up here. I believe it's called the Tubbs Fire, but it was back in October. And in this area I was driving around at, 90% of the homes were destroyed, leveled by this fire that just really came across. And according to some of the people I've talked with, really was a fire that exploded within hours and was just devastating. Well, that's about it. Like I said, we're putting the wraps on this one. And until we talk again, keep shoveling.